From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a closer look at stories from our radio newsrooms across the nation. Today, On Deadline is turning our attention overseas, where we're eyeing several ongoing and far-reaching conflicts, including a major prisoner swap with Russia, tension rising in the Middle East, and concerns about how long Ukraine's offensive can last. Let's start with that prisoner swap. It's been years in the making. Finally, U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, and Russian-American radio journalist Alsu Kermasheva were freed. So how did we get here? The real movement on the prisoner swap that freed these three Americans from months of detainment in Russia can be dated back to last month, when Gershkovich was found guilty of espionage there. After 3 days of hearings, the United States dubbed it a sham trial. President Joe Biden went as far as to say that Gershkovich was targeted by the Russian government because he was a journalist and an American. Gershkovich had been accused by Russian authorities of spying and was detained in March of 2023. Gershkovich had already been living in the country for 6 years. He'd even worked at the Moscow Times, which is a Russian publication. Whelan and Kermasheva were detained on similar allegations. Experts pointed out that without a conviction for Gershkovich, a prisoner exchange couldn't have been made possible. So he was actually the linchpin in this situation. In the end, after a complex negotiation, 24 total prisoners were exchanged between Russia, the U.S., Germany, and three other Western countries. To break down more on the swap and what went into it, CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland joined Odyssey.
Now, this was a complex deal. It had been in the works for quite some time.
Yes, Steve, this was the largest swap of this kind of character of prisoners since the end of the Cold War, and 7 countries overall were involved, and a rough several dozen people total on both sides were, in fact, released. And it appears that President Biden was very closely involved, interceding directly with Olaf Scholz, the Chancellor of Germany, the head of Slovenia, and others to pull this whole thing together.
Now, there were several countries involved in this. I know Germany had to be convinced to hand over a convicted killer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, his name is Vadim Kolesnikov, and he is a 58-year-old former colonel in the Russian FSB, Russian Internal Security. And he was detained in Germany following the murder of a Chechen national that he shot and killed publicly in a Berlin park, who had been a commando and fought against Russian forces in the early 2000s. So he was the guy that the Russians really wanted, and it had been always in the background of this particular negotiation. Sadly, at one point in this negotiation, apparently Alexei Navalny was going to be released as part of this sort of multi-prisoner swap. His death prior to that being effected obviously took that out of the equation.
Jeff, I know you have your ear to the ground on the Middle East, and you are hearing that there could be a strike against Israel in the coming days. Tell us what you've learned.
Well, who we have, of course, the Israelis conducted, an airstrike in Beirut, capital of Lebanon, and killed a senior military commander of Hezbollah following a missile strike that killed 12 youngsters at a village, a Druze village in very, very northern Israel a few days ago. A day or so after that, the Israelis conducted a bombing, actually of a guest house in Tehran, killing Ismail Haniyeh, who is the senior political leader of Hamas, who was there attending the inauguration of the new president of Tehran, and the guest house he was staying in was actually an Iranian Revolutionary Guard-controlled guest house. And somehow the Israelis had been able to plant a bomb in that building, which had been there for several months, it's reported, until it was detonated. So the embarrassment to the new president of Iran and the Iranian regime more broadly couldn't, in fact, Steve, be greater. And as a consequence, it seems to me, both Iran, Hezbollah in particular, now have enormous pressure and incentive internally to do something to respond to the safe face globally and also to answer the domestic narrative. And I think they're trying to coordinate that response, which could occur, I think, sometime over this weekend or maybe next weekend to limit civilian casualties. And the baseline will probably be the April 19th attack that Iran effected against Israel, that you may recall was 300 cruise missiles, rockets, and drones launched against Israel.
As McCausland mentioned, while the prisoner exchange was a positive moment for the U.S. and Russia's long-strained relationship, international tension is ongoing. Most notably, perhaps, in the Middle East, where Israel is continuing its efforts to eliminate Hamas while the world and the U.S. call for a ceasefire. However, after the assassinations of Hezbollah military commander Fouad Shukr, who was killed in Beirut, and Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh, who was killed in Tehran, many are wondering if a ceasefire is even attainable. Israel has taken credit for the assassination of Shukr and is being blamed for the death of Haniyeh. Many are now suggesting that ceasefire talks between Hamas and Israel could be bumpy to say the least, as Haniyeh was the main party representing Hamas at the negotiating table. U.S. Representative Keith Self, a Republican from Texas and a veteran, joined Odyssey to share his thoughts.
I wanted to tap into your wealth of information, not just as a member of Congress, but as a retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel. You've served in the Special Forces, the Army Rangers. You've got a lot of experience both on and off the political field. And as we are, I mean, actively watching for breaking news this morning out of Israel and Iran, give us your take. What should our level of concern be that we're on the brink of a larger war?
I think that's exactly right. We need to be very careful with this. I've been dealing with Iran since 1984 when I was in the 82nd Airborne Division Plans Office. And I think we're in a very dangerous period today. Just think about it. The attacks on Al-Saud Air Base in Iraq have now been verified as Iranian missiles. They've told the commercial airliners that don't trust GPS over Iran for the next few days. They're going to be jamming it. And frankly, the Russian secretary of the Russian Security Council arrived in Iran yesterday. So this is a very volatile, very dangerous time.
You know, so much was made, and you're, of course, on the Foreign Affairs Committee, so you're privy to information that most of us, frankly, are not. But you touched on Russia, and, you know, we a few administrations ago talked regularly about the axis of evil, and it seems as if we have a new axis that includes, but is not limited to, Iran and Russia.
Well, Iran, Russia, and China, because China is the one behind all of it. And the Russian emissary to Iran yesterday is very concerning, because if they're trying to deplete our military, and we're not prepared for even one major regional war, much less multiples, if they're trying to deplete our military, one way to do it would be to go to a regional war where we might support, and that's questionable under the Biden administration, but if we would support Israel, it would further deplete our military. So this is very concerning in terms of participation, and our people are tired of the forever wars in the sandbox. So this is a concern to me. Are they trying to deplete our U.S. military?
We're talking to United States Congressman Keith Self from Texas' 3rd Congressional District. And as we're talking about these regional conflicts, regional wars, and Russia and China involved with Israel, and as you alluded, we're seeing airlines that are cutting all their flights in and out of Tel Aviv and in and out of that region out of growing concern. I checked with the State Department website to see about travel advisories, and you're pretty much not advised to travel anywhere in Israel or surrounding countries. How does this end? How do we resolve this?
Well, the U.S. has to stand strong right now, and I think Secretary Austin is trying to do what he can. He's moving forces toward Israel, ships, and I think that we will have to stand to deter Iran. This is our moment. That our weakness has been setting this up since the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan 3 years ago. But now is the time. We have got to stand, because we don't want a major regional war. We don't want to participate in a major major regional war. This is our time to say to Iran, stand down, because we are going to participate if we have to. But deterrence is not only the capability, it's also the will to do what you must do to deter. And that's what we need to be telling Iran today.
But the conflict between Israel and Hamas, and the Houthis, and potentially Iran, isn't all that's going on. While many have hoped for some sort of solution by now, the war in Ukraine continues without an end in sight. Even with continued support from the United States and its other allies, Ukraine is still sustaining heavy losses as a result of the Russian invasion. They did flip the script with a surprise incursion into Russian territory, but many are wondering how long that can last. And now with a potential administration change in the U.S., some are worried that support for the country could be reduced or even removed altogether. For example, the GOP's vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, has fought against any assistance to Ukraine. That's something that Biden and many Democrats argue would mean essentially giving Russian Federation President Vladimir Putin free rein over Ukraine, and then potentially threatening security in the rest of Europe. Brendan Kearney is a military analyst and retired colonel with the U.S. Marine Corps. He joined Odyssey to share more on when the war in Ukraine might potentially end.
So is this a real sort of offensive, or is this public relations? Is this to make a morale booster? What is it?
I think it's all of those things, tell you the truth. You know, the Ukrainians lost the initiative on the battlefield about 6 months ago, even longer than that. The Russians have made some very, very small advances in a number of places along that eastern front, the west eastern front of Ukraine and the western front of Russia. And I think what this is that the Ukrainians are basically regaining the initiative, regaining the momentum. And what they're going to do is see how this develops. The Russians are having a hard time. This is about 4 days old now. They're having a hard time sort of containing the Ukrainians. So this is going to be very interesting to watch over the next couple of days, because if it goes the way the Ukrainians would want, it would be that they'll exploit success, if success is becomes something that they start to enjoy there.
Well, as you're well aware, the old saying goes, amateurs talk strategy, professionals talk logistics. Do the Ukrainians have the resources to continue something like this?
I think they do now. I think since this special military operation started 2.5 years ago by the Russians have shown again and again and again that their ability to supply their own troops is just non-existent. It's been one of the darkest failures of the Russian military campaign. On the other side, the Ukrainians have done very, very well, except when they were suffering from those periodic shortages of ammunition. And that was primarily because the West, and the United States in particular, simply let the ammunition supply dry up as it was heading into Ukraine. That's not the case right now. The Ukrainians are I think, have probably built up more than enough ammunition to go ahead and take care of this offensive and probably most likely to see them through the remainder of this year. You know, we're not far from winter. It may not seem like it in August, but once winter starts coming in late October and early November into Ukraine, to that part of the world, military operations tend to slow down dramatically. They don't stop, but they'll slow down.
Yeah, just ask Napoleon and Hitler, and it's stopped a lot of people in the
General Mudd.
Exactly,
General Mudd.
look, we you're right about the resources of Russia trying to rush those to the battlefield. We're also here; they're trying to conscript more fighters and send them there. Does Russia have fighters that they could do that with?
Well, you know, I think the answer to that comes in who the Russians have publicly described they are conscripting. They've essentially emptied their jails there in Russia and gone ahead and brought in convicts, given them the opportunity to have their sentences dramatically reduced by serving in the Russian military. Sadly, a lot of those sentences turn into death for these young men, and I'm sure some women that are also involved in it. So the Russians are hurting when it comes to drafting personnel. They increased the age limits well up into the mid-60s here about a year ago. And we have to remember that when they instituted the draft in the summer of 2022, that over 1 million Russian men voted with their feet and they fled Russia. And many of these men were some of their most talented people in terms of what they could bring to the table, not only in the military, but just they were the best educated. And they have fled to the West and they're making lives for themselves in the West. They cannot return to Russia. They would be subject to, Russian law, which is, as we all know, is draconian. So it's an interesting situation. They, lower demographic rates for the last couple of decades have really impacted Russia's ability to go ahead and man a military campaign. So we're going to have to see what this how this turns out over the midterm.
In In other interesting news connected to Russia, the North American Aerospace Defense Command said earlier this summer that Russian and Chinese military planes were intercepted. Those planes were operating in the Alaska Air Defense Identification Zone. While the planes remained in international airspace, never entering American or Canadian sovereign airspace, it was considered yet another show of force from Putin. Have you ever had a little sibling or cousin put their finger an inch from your face and chant, "I'm not touching you"? It's kind of the same thing. And this airspace situation happened after Russia made another show of force even earlier this summer when its submarines showed up outside of Cuba. Called to account for it, Putin declared it a routine military operation. Then there's also Putin's support for North Korea. The Russian leader made an appearance in the country and met with leader Kim Jong-un as the two continued to build their relationship. During his visit, Putin stirred the pot again with his denouncement of what he said was, quote, U.S. economic pressure, provocation, blackmail, and military threats. As you can see, the situation is ever-changing. We could say that about a lot of things. Here at home, we also have elections amid assassination attempts and the incumbent president dropping out of the race. So be sure to keep listening to On Deadline as we keep you up to date on everything you need to know at home and abroad. This show is produced by Joe Heady, Christy Strouser, and me. I'm Lauren Berry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.